Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, January 12, 2026 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, sunny, highs to 68 degrees Fahrenheit, winds east-southeast at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight's weather, clear skies, lows to 43 degrees Fahrenheit, winds east southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. And tomorrow's forecast predicts mainly sunny, highs to 71 degrees Fahrenheit, winds east-southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Now from the Arizona Daily Star front page title, first article is titled, Economy is Key Issue for Governor. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. Dateline Phoenix. Arizona hit its highest unemployment figure in November since the end of the COVID pandemic and the recession it caused. The 4.3% seasonally adjusted rate is not that much higher than the prior numbers, and it still is 0.3 point below the figures for the same month nationally. But the numbers are being closely watched because they come as Arizona is headed into a statewide election with the bid by incumbent Governor Katie Hobbs to get another four-year term. Hobbs' State of the State speech Monday is a chance for her to make the argument that, overall, the economy has been good, and there have been a series of victories. Those include employment expansion by firms like chipmaker TSMC, LG Energy Solutions, which is building a battery manufacturing complex, and Amkor Technology, which is involved in semiconductor packaging and testing. But the three Republicans who are hoping to get a nod from their party to face off against Hobbs are making the state's economy an issue. The latest overall report is more of a mixed bag with some bright signs, said Doug Walz, chief economist for the State Office of Economic Opportunity. Not at the least of that is, he said, the fact that Arizona continues to outperform the national average. Walz also said wages in Arizona are up by 6.4% since the same time last year, compared with a 4.3% increase nationally. Even with that, however, the average Arizonan is earning $35.46 per hour, which is $1.54 less than the national average. There are other signs in the collection of numbers monitored by both OEO and the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. The overall number of people with jobs in Arizona continues to increase, but Walz said the rate of increase is slower than it was prior to the pandemic. And it's not just the unemployment numbers that are indicators of economic health. One of those is the rate of job openings, a figure compounded by dividing the number of job openings by the total employment. That dropped to 4.8% in Arizona in the most recent months and is now far below the nearly 8% figure in 2023. At the same time, the hires rate, determined by the number of new hires by total employment, is down to 3.2% from 3.8% a month earlier. It could be that employers are just less certain of the economic environment to come, Walz said. They're just not hiring as many new individuals as opposed to really hurting and having to lay people off. All that, he said, is consistent with the higher unemployment rate. But there's also another figure that is already becoming an issue in the 2026 governor's race, how Arizona is doing in comparison to other states. Just this past week, Republican Congressman Andy Biggs, who was running for governor, put out emails claiming that Arizona fell to 47th nationally in job growth in 2025. He called it a stunning fall for a state recognized for its growing economy over the previous decade. And Karen Taylor Robson, another GOP gubernatorial hopeful, has cited the same number of 47 figure in calling into a radio talk show where Hobbs was being interviewed, calling it a precipitous decline in job growth and job creation. The problem, that number is based solely on job growth for just the first half of last year. Arizona was shedding more jobs during the several of those months than it created. But a more realistic figure is to look at year-over-year growth. There is, in fact, some data to show how weak the economy was at that time. Even numbers on this OEO website show Arizona at 41st for job growth from the June 2024 to June 2025. That figure, however, can be misleading based on the time period covered. For example, that same chart shows the most recent figures for Arizona year over year is number 22. But Biggs isn't the only one picking and choosing what numbers to use. The next front page article is titled Undocumented Students Face In-State Tuition Challenges. This article was written by Molly Bohannon of the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. From the start of high school, Ignacio knew he wanted to go to college to become a nurse practitioner. But when he learned that being undocumented disqualified him from in-state tuition at Arizona's three public universities, his plans unraveled. It was definitely a hard time navigating through high school knowing that I probably wasn't going to be able to go afford college, said Ignacio, who's being identified by his first name because of his immigration status. I was like, it's unattainable. I'm not even going to try hard. That shifted during his senior year, though, when he learned of Proposition 308. The 2022 ballot initiative promised in-state tuition to students who had graduated from an Arizona high school after attending at least 2 years, regardless of their immigration status. Proposition 308, it changed my perspective on things, he said. It motivated me just to keep going. The initiative narrowly passed that November with 51.2% of the vote. The following spring, Ignacio enrolled in the Estrella Mountain Community College. His career goal changed, and he eventually transferred to the University of Arizona, where he is now pursuing a double major in law and political science. Ignacio's experience reflects what Proposition 308 was designed to do: reopen college as a realistic option for undocumented students who had grown up in Arizona. But 3 years after the law took effect, it remains difficult to say how many students have actually benefited and how many were left behind. Though national experts estimated that more than 3,600 undocumented students a year could qualify for in-state tuition under the measure, Arizona put no centralized system in place to oversee its rollout, track participation, or ensure consistent implementation across colleges and university. There wasn't an effort from the governor or board of regents or any other effort to implement it. Jose Patino, vice president of education at Aliento, a nonprofit working with undocumented Arizonans, told AZCIR, it was left basically to people who cared. As a result, students and advocates have shouldered much of the work required to benefit from the law during a moment when political hostility towards immigrants has intensified nationally. Advocates suspect some students are still paying the higher 150% tuition rate that applied to undocumented students at state universities before Proposition 308 passed, while others may be foregoing college entirely. I think at the end of the day, even though we want them to advocate for themselves, the students shouldn't have to carry that burden of having to go look for resources, said Blanca Alcantara Hershey, a coordinator in the University of Arizona's AGAVE office, a student support center. We could avoid all that by having a streamlined process. Arizona's disjointed implementation has taken on a new urgency as the Trump administration moves to challenge tuition equity laws in other states, creating confusion and fear among families weighing whether college is worth the risk. Taken together, the gaps suggest Arizona may have missed a narrow chance to make the promise of Prop 308 real, and advocates say students are paying the price. Along with Washington, D.C., Arizona was one of 22 states with a tuition equity law on the books as of September. Texas and California were the first to implement such measures in 2001. These policies often draw bipartisan support given their potential to reduce high school dropout rates, encourage undocumented students to pursue higher education, and provide an economic boost. One 2022 analysis projected that students enrolling under Propositions 308 could strengthen the workforce and inject about $23 million into the state economy, while another found that any lost tuition revenue from in-state rates could be offset by increased enrollment. In Arizona, three Republican lawmakers sponsored the bill to take the matters to voters, and it received overwhelming support from the Democrats. The Yes on Proposition 308 committee was also chaired by a Republican, and groups like Aliento and Scholarships AZ worked alongside the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce and other business leaders to secure its passage. Not all Republicans endorsed the measure, however. Some who had supported a 2006 initiative barring students without lawful status from receiving aid or in-state tuition urged voters to oppose Proposition 308, citing concerns about tuition costs and fairness. After the initiative passed in 2022, the Arizona Board of Regents, which oversees Arizona State University, Northern Arizona University, and the University of Arizona, held a meeting to revise its non-resident tuition policy. At the time, ABOR Executive Director John Arnold, now UA's Chief Financial Officer, acknowledged that only a small number of students would be affected immediately, but said he hoped participation would dramatically increase over the coming years. Arnold described the procedural policy change as pretty straightforward, and it passed unanimously. But multiple regents raised pointed questions about its implementation, including whether the three universities were prepared to enact the change the following semester and whether there was any sort of communications plan to ensure that qualified students know about this. Arnold replied that the universities were excited to move the program forward, and that ABOR would rely on the schools to ensure eligible students were informed. Regent Larry Penley pushed back, arguing responsibility extended beyond the universities. When we offer these opportunities to students, promotion really is incumbent upon us, said Penley, who did not respond to AZCIR's recent request for comment. And in many cases, I don't think we're taking as seriously as we need to do the job to join with the three universities and really promote things like this to the public. Advocates working with undocumented students applying to college would likely agree with Penley's assessment. Several told AZCIR that implementation lacked consistency because schools approached it differently, often requesting varying documents and information to prove eligibility. That led to confusion for students. Carolina Silva, executive director of Scholarships A through Z, which assists undocumented students in Southern Arizona, said one school asked for a driver's license to prove residency, something those without legal status cannot obtain in Arizona. Her organization intervened, she said, helping the schools identify alternative documents students could realistically provide. Some institutions created more hoops for students to jump through, not realizing, again, it would become another barrier, Silva said. It's continued to just be a battle every step of the way. AZCIR requested information from 22 universities and community colleges on how many students have received in-state tuition through Prop 308 since it took effect. Just 7 schools were able to provide a number. 14 said they did not track usage, which is not required under the law. Yavapai College did not answer repeated requests for information. Across the 7 schools with data, about 720 students have received in-state tuition through the initiative as of the fall of 2025 semester. 432 at Arizona State University, nearly 200 at Pima Community College, and fewer than 70 at UA. For comparison, there are an estimated 11,000 undocumented students enrolled in higher education in Arizona, with about 1,000 graduating from high school annually. Asked about AZCIR's findings, a spokesman for Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs said the language approved by voters did not designate a lead agency for Prop 308 implementation, leaving responsibility to the Arizona Board of Regents for the state's public universities and the governing boards of the state's community college districts. ABOR spokesperson Megan Gilbertson insisted the board provided clear policies, supported the schools in interpreting the law, and providing system-wide coordination. She repeatedly pointed to the board's FAQ page for Proposition 308, which she said is updated as questions arise. Gilbertson did not share specifics about how the board communicated with schools to ensure consistency, however, acknowledging that each university student information system is uniquely configured. As with the universities, implementation at community colleges was left to individual campuses, according to David Borofsky, executive director of the Arizona Community College Coordinating Council. The nonprofit works to support and promote collaboration among community colleges. Policy changes involving access to immigration students often cause confusion and errors at first, requiring active monitoring to work as intended, according to Tanya Broder, Senior Counsel of Health and Economic Justice Policy at the National Immigration Law Center. You can't just declare victory and go home, she said. You really need to invest in making sure that these laws lead to good outcomes for the people. The FAQ document crafted and updated by the Board of Regents does not spell out how students can show they qualify for in-state tuition. It instead directs those with questions to contact the Financial Aid or Residency Classification Office at their university. What happens next largely depends on where a student enrolls. Ignacio, who received an in-state tuition at Estrella Mountain Community College before transferring to UA, said the process wasn't particularly difficult at Estrella Mountain. At UA, finding the correct form to show he qualified definitely took some digging. The UA's registrar site outlines the documentation requirements and links to a form for students seeking the Arizona High School Graduate Qualifying Non-Citizen Tuition Rate. Students at Pima Community College likewise must submit a form and documentation, though a spokesperson said the specific paperwork required can vary depending on each student's situation. Jessica Martinez, a coordinator for UA's AGAV office, said students who learned of their eligibility, or rather of their eligibility, through community organizations such as Scholarships A to Z often know how to proceed. Those without that support may not know where to look. Officials at ASU and Maricopa County Colleges, the latter of which could not provide a count of students using Prop 308, said applicants do not need to submit extra paperwork. Eligibility is determined using materials already included in the applications, such as high school transcripts. We looked at making sure we weren't collecting unnecessary information that wasn't required under the law just to make a barrier of enrollment that much easier for our students, said Lindsay Wilson, a Maricopa Community College's spokesperson. Lesley, an undocumented student being identified only by her first name, applied to ASU in the fall of 2022 before Prop 308 took effect and was classified as an out-of-state resident after being accepted. Her high school counselor called the university, explained Leslie's status, and her residency classification and tuition rate were corrected. Without her counselor, though, Leslie, who saw college as too costly before Prop 308, said she would have struggled to navigate the mix-up. I would have been stuck, and I just wouldn't know where to start or where to go, Leslie said. Officials at NAU declined to explain how their students indicate they qualify and instead directed AZCIR to the university's Prop 308 website, which does not include instructions for demonstrating eligibility. Silva, with Scholarships A to Z, said the qualification process can hinge on who you know within the admissions office at any given school. It's kind of still like three times the amount of work and time and headache a regular student would do, she said. Those added hurdles come as an unprecedented nationwide crackdown on immigrants has heightened the stakes for undocumented students and their families. Patino with Aliento said uncertainty around the on-campus immigration enforcement and post-graduation path to employment is making some questions whether higher education is worth pursuing at all. How do we speak to the community about Prop 308 and college, given the climate that is going on at the federal level, he asked. In April, President Donald Trump signed an executive order directing federal agencies to stop the enforcement of local laws regranting in-state higher education tuition to undocumented students, contending they favor aliens over any groups of American citizens. As of January 6, his administration had sued 7 states, Illinois, California, Oklahoma, Minnesota, Kentucky, Texas, and Virginia, over tuition equity laws and policies. Kentucky, Texas, Virginia, and Oklahoma sought to comply with the federal directive and end their policies but are facing challenges in court. Florida voluntarily repealed its law in February. So far, the administration has not challenged Arizona's statute, and State Attorney General Chris May has issued an opinion affirming that Prop 308 complies with relevant federal laws. Still, advocates say the national backdrop continues to shape how families weigh their options. As Silva works to increase visibility around Prop 308, she said she has seen a shift in attitude among some of the families her organization assists, noting they are just really scared in this moment. Despite that fear, she emphasized that there is more access in Arizona than there has been for the past 20 years if students know how to claim it. The next front page article is titled, What's Next for Venezuela? This article was written by Franklin Briseño, Maria Verza, and Nayara Butchke of the Associated Press, Dateline Lima, Peru. Almost immediately after U.S. forces deposed Venezuela's president, officials from Washington to Lima, Peru began encouraging some of the 8 million Venezuelans who have scattered themselves across the Americas over more than a decade to go home. But that idea has not even crossed the mind of Yanalis Torres. The 22-year-old graphic designer was too busy printing T-shirts with images of captured former Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro overlaid with phrases like game over. Her clients in Lima's textile market were snatching them up within hours of the news of Maduro's downfall. Settled or undocumented, many of the millions of Venezuelans spread across Lima, or rather Latin America, received news of Maduro's capture with joy, but also caution, especially after hearing U.S. President Donald Trump say that he would work with Maduro's vice president, now interim president Delcy Rodriguez, rather than the opposition. Despite leaders in Peru and Chile echoing U.S. suggestions to return to Venezuela, the diaspora does not appear ready to do so. Venezuela's economy remains in a shambles, and with the exception of Maduro and his wife, the government remains in place. I have lots of things here, there, Torres said from her shop in the bustling Lima neighborhood, adding it would take time for things to change in Venezuela. You got to keep an eye on it and know what's going on, but not lose hope. There are already 7 million Venezuelan migrants and refugees in Latin America. Colombia tops the list with 2.8 million, followed by Peru with 1.5 million. A further estimated 1 million are in the United States, according to the most recent data from R4V, a network tracking the diaspora and coordinated by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and the International Organization for Migration. They were driven out by the compounding political and economic crisis. An estimated 8 in 10 people in Venezuela live in poverty in a country that was once one of Latin America's wealthiest and with the world's largest proven oil reserves. Some have found work or started small businesses, while others tried to reach the U.S. or bounce from country to country. Over the last year, thousands have been deported to Venezuela or third countries, and many more could be near the end of their protected status in the U.S. Eduardo Constant, 36, left Venezuela in 2017 in the middle of a hunger crisis. Speaking from a migrant shelter in the northern Mexican city of Monterrey, he recalled his journey. He had spent 3 months in Colombia, a country overwhelmed by the numbers of arriving Venezuelans, 3 years in Peru, which he left during the pandemic because they wouldn't give him the vaccine, and then 3 more years in Chile, where he was unable to legalize his status. Finally, he made the long trek through South America, the Darien jungle, and up to the U.S. border just in time for Trump to close it to asylum seekers. I had plans in Europe, but if things settle down in Venezuela, I'm going to Venezuela, he said. His joy at Maduro's ouster was moderated by the worries of the family he still has there over food scarcity and security forces that search people's cell phones for signs of opposition, he said. Maureen Meyer, a vice president for programs at WOLA, a Washington-based human rights organization focused on Latin America, said, we're nowhere near where we're going to have a country where people that fled feel that they could be comfortably returning. And if Venezuelans are forced to leave the countries where they are now, under pressure or via deportation, they will be even more vulnerable to organized crime groups in the region seeking to exploit them now that the business of smuggling them north has dropped off. Johannes Zelensky de Nazareth Marquez, a 22-year-old Venezuelan, heard of Maduro's capture while riding across Mexico on a bus with her 3-year-old son. They had left Venezuela in February 2024 and turned themselves into the U.S. Border Patrol that June. She was picked up by U.S. immigration agents in Pennsylvania last year and deported to Mexico with her son on January 1st. They were headed with other deportees to the southern state of Tabasco when she heard about Maduro. "We all shouted with joy. It was what we all wanted," she said. Still getting her bearings, Marquez planned to apply for asylum in Mexico and try to find work, but she is worried. She doesn't know how long they will be allowed to stay in the shelter, and she heard about kidnappings in the area. "I'm afraid of being out on the street with my son alone. It's a bit dangerous there," she said. Mayor said forces were building to create a perfect storm for Venezuelans like Marquez, who found themselves outside their country and without legal status. Their prospects are not looking good. In Chile, a ultra-conservative president-elect José Antonio Kast, who will take office in March, made deporting hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants central to his campaign. This week, Kast said they have 63 days left to leave our country and to have the possibilities of returning with all of their papers in order. Peru and Colombia are also scheduled to elect new presidents this year, and immigration will be a focus. Last week, Kast met with Peru's interim president, José Ujiri, and among the ideas that both men have mentioned is creating some sort of humanitarian corridor passing through Chile, Peru, and Ecuador to make it easier for Venezuelans to return home. Some of these big host countries, how they decide to respond to the population that are already in their countries and those that may come will be the key, Meyer said. In Santiago, in the 8-block Little Caracas, initial celebrations with car horns, shouts, and reggaeton music had calmed. Alexander Leal, 66, who arrived with his wife in 2018, expressed hope as he sold homemade ice cream in the Southern Hemisphere summer. His family is scattered across the globe, some in the United States, others in Europe, and 4 siblings still in Venezuela. He dreams of returning one day. "It won't be this year, but maybe it'll be the next year," he said. "That is everyone's aspiration, that the country is fixed," he said. Trump's help would be necessary. Jessica Mendoza, a 27-year-old Uber driver and mother, knows that she is one of the thousands of undocumented immigrants in CAS sites, but she plans to stick it out. Returning is not an option. Venezuela's neighbor Colombia has received more Venezuelans than any other country and has largely been applauded for its efforts to help them settle, like an offer of 10-year residency permits. A close security ally of the United States, Colombia is navigating a tense moment in its relationship with the U.S. under President Gustavo Petro, who has sparred with Trump and at times been the target of his ire. Angel Bruguez, a 54-year-old Venezuelan who has lived in Bogota for 6 months with his wife and daughter and runs an empanada business there, expressed gratitude for Colombia's hospitality. He said he did not celebrate Maduro's capture and is well aware of the fear his relatives still in Venezuela live with. "Returning would be crazy," he said. Now we'll pause to remind you that you're listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll return to the front page for the next article. It's titled, "Homeowners Struggle to Rebuild a Year After LA Fires." This article was written by Alex Vega and Gabriela Unguera of the Associated Press. Dateline Los Angeles. On the first anniversary of the most destructive wildfires in the LA area, the scant home construction projects stand out among the still mostly flattened landscapes. Fewer than a dozen homes have been rebuilt in the Los Angeles County since January 7, 2025, when the Palisades and Eaton fires erupted. killing 31 people and destroying about 13,000 homes and other residential properties. For those who have had insurance, it's often not enough to cover costs of construction. Relief organizations are stepping in to help, but progress is slow. Among the exceptions is Ted Kerner, whose Altadena home was reduced to ash and to chimneys. With his insurance payout tied up, the 60-year-old liquidated about 80% of his retirement holdings, secured contractors quickly, and moved decisively through the rebuilding process. Shortly before Thanksgiving, Kerner was among the first to establish a rebuild in the aftermath of the fires, which were fueled by drought and hurricane-force winds. But most do not have options like Kerner. The streets of the coastal community, Palisades and Altadena, a community in the foothills of the San Gabriel Mountains, remain lined with dirt lots. In the seaside city of Malibu, foundations and concrete piles rising out of the sand are all that's left of beachfront homes that once butted against crashing ocean waves. Neighborhoods are pitch black at night with few street lamps replaced. Even many homes that survived are not inhabited as families struggle to clear them of the fire's toxic contaminants. About 900 homes are under construction, potentially on pace to be completed later this year. Still, many homeowners are stuck as they figure out whether they can pay for the rebuilding process. Scores of residents have left their communities for good. More than 600 properties where a single family home was destroyed in the wildfires have been sold, according to real estate data tracker Cotality. We're seeing huge gaps between the money insurance is paying out to the extent we have insurance and what it will actually cost to rebuild and or remediate our homes, said Joy Chen, executive director of the Eden Fire Survivors Network, a group of 10,000 fire survivors, mostly from Altadena. In September, less than 20% of people experienced total home loss had closed out their insurance claims. According to a survey by the nonprofit Department of Angels, about one-third of insured respondents had policies with State Farm, the state's largest private insurer, or the California Fair Plan, the insurers of last resort. They reported higher rates of dissatisfaction with both, citing burdensome requirements, lowball estimates, and dealing with multiple adjusters. In November, Los Angeles County opened a civil investigation into State Farm's practices and potential violations of the state's unfair competition law. Chen said the group has seen a flurry of substantial payouts since then. Without answers from insurance, households can't commit to rebuilding projects that can easily exceed $1 million. They're worried about getting started and running out of money, Chen said. Jessica Rogers discovered only after the Palisades fire destroyed her home that her coverage had been canceled. The mother of two's fallback was a low-interest loan from the Small Business Administration, but the application process was grueling. After losing her job because of the fire and then having her identity stolen, her approval for $550,000 came through last month. She's still weighing how she'll cover the remaining costs and says she wonders, do I empty out my 401k and start counting every penny in a penny jar around the apartment? Rogers, now executive director of the Pacific Palisades Long-Term Recovery Group, estimates there are hundreds like her in the Pacific Palisades who are stuck dealing with FEMA and SBA and figuring out if we could piecemeal something together to build our homes. That so few homes have been rebuilt a year after the wildfires echoes the recovery pattern of a December 2021 blaze that erupted south of border Colorado, destroying more than 1,000 homes. At the one-year mark, many lots had been cleared of debris and many residents had applied for building permits, said Andrew Rumbach, co-lead of the Climate and Communities Program at Urban Institute. Around the 18-month mark is when you start to really see significant progress in terms of going from handfuls to hundreds of homes rebuilt. Time will bring the scope of problems into focus. You're going to start to see some real inequalities start to emerge where certain neighborhoods, certain types of people, certain types of properties are just lagging away, far behind, and that becomes a really important question in the second years of a recovery. who's doing well and who's really struggling and why, Rumba said. That's a key concern in Altadena, which for decades drew aspiring black homeowners who otherwise faced redlining and other forms of racial discrimination when they sought to buy a home in other LA area communities. In 2024, 81% of black households in Altadena owned their homes, nearly twice the average, near twice the national black home ownership rate. But recent research by UCLA's Latino Policy and Politics Institute found that as of August 7th, in 10 Altadena homeowners, 7 in 10 Altadena homeowners whose properties were severely damaged in last year's wildfire had not begun taking steps to rebuild or sell their home. Among these, black homeowners were 73% more likely than others to have taken no action. Al and Charlotte Bailey have been living in an RV parked on the empty lot where their homes once stood. The Baileys are paying out, they're paying for their rebuild with funds from their insurance payout and a loan. They're also hoping to receive money from Southern California Edison. Several lawsuits claim its equipment sparked the fire in Altadena. We had been here for 41 years and raised our family here, and in one night it was all gone, said Al Bailey, 77. We decided that whatever it's going to cost, this is our community. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. The first article is titled, Agencies Disagree on Lear Crash. This article was written by Perry Vandell of the Arizona Republic. The National Transportation Safety Board urged the Federal Aviation Administration to require operators of certain Learjet models to confirm the landing gear was properly installed after its investigation of a fatal crash at Scottsdale Airport nearly a year ago. The NTSB released a preliminary report shortly after the crash that described how a Learjet 35A owned by Motley Crue singer Vince Neil crashed into another aircraft after its landing gear appeared to fail, causing it to veer off the runway and crash into a parked Gulfstream G200, killing the Learjet's pilot and injuring several others. The Learjet was not equipped with reverse thrusters, and its drag chute was not deployed, according to the report. Police identified the fatality as 78-year-old pilot Joey Witoski. Witoski's daughter, Jana Scherzer, previously told the Arizona Republic that Witoski began flying after joining the U.S. Marine Corps, where he served several tours in the Vietnam War. In a follow-up report issued on October 29, 2025, NTSB investigators found that the Learjet's landing gear had been improperly installed. The report noted that a pin wasn't fully inserted into a casting and that a mechanic who lubricated the landing gear in December 2024 found nothing unusual other than the left landing gear having an excessive amount of grease. The images captured shortly before the plane's landing show the Learjet's left landing gear trailing farther behind from its normal position and ultimately separated from the plane shortly after landing. Investigators learned that it wasn't the first time that type of landing gear had disconnected from the aircraft, citing occurrences in 1995, 2001, and 2008. However, none of those incidents resulted in death or injury. The NTSB concluded its report by requesting the FAA issued an airworthiness directive that would require those operating Learjets with the same type of landing gear to inspect the aircraft and ensure the landing gears were correctly installed within 25 flights, while noting that only 12% of the 1,883 aircraft in service had been inspected. The agency criticized a decision by the FAA made in July 2025 that found a mandatory inspection was unnecessary. The FAA's decision is particularly difficult to justify in view of the imminent risk of loss of life from a similar incident. The minimal effort required to accomplish the inspections, an estimated 2 hours per airplane, and the fact that the Bombardier itself has urged the FAA to mandate compliance through an airworthiness directive, the report states. The NTSB also recommended that Learjet maintenance manuals be updated to highlight examples of properly installed landing gears to ensure various parts were positioned correctly. Brian Bedford, the FEA administrator, responded to the NTSB recommendations on December 8th, stating that the agency brought the issue before a review board in November, which ultimately decided against mandating inspections and instead issued a bulletin recommending Learjet operators to inspect the landing gears. Bedford added that Learjet already made temporary revisions to its maintenance manuals that adequately addressed the NTSB other recommendations. Ian Greger, an FAA spokesperson, referred back to the Bedford's response when asked about the NTSB concerns over fewer planes receiving inspections without the FAA mandating they be performed. After the fatal crash in Scottsdale, NTSB investigators learned that the same plane and flight crew experienced a landing mishap on June 20, 2024 in McAllister, Oklahoma, where the plane landed hard just before getting to the runway and bounced several times, causing both the left main landing gear tire to burst. An NTSB report states the Learjet owners hired a mechanic who worked on it for the previous owner to perform a hard landing inspection. Investigators interviewed the mechanic, who said he used a maintenance manual for all the work he performed. The NTSB wasn't notified about the hard landing and didn't open an investigation as a result. The next article is titled "Suit Filed After Glendale Cop Kills Tucson Man." This article was written by Elena Santa Cruz of Arizona Republic. A mistaken identification by Glendale police has resulted in a lawsuit and an officer being fired because officials believed he could pose a safety risk to the community. Dylan Seebeck, who authorities have said was from Tucson, was shot and killed January 8, 2025, after officers thought he was a domestic violence suspect they were looking for at Horizon Park near 47th and Diana Avenues. His family has filed a wrongful death lawsuit saying the 46-year-old posed no threat and was hundreds of feet away when Officer Juan Gonzalez shot him multiple times. The complaint further alleges that Sergeant Joshua Anderson failed to intervene and took over 15 minutes to instruct officers to provide aid to Seebeck. The lawsuit was filed in federal court December 31st, weeks after Glendale City Manager Kevin Phelps told Gonzalez in a letter that his actions in the shooting directly result in the death of an innocent victim, and that he couldn't in good conscience allow him to stay on the job. Phelps said his decision was also based on the fact that Gonzalez had previously been disciplined for failing to properly handle display and use his firearm. Glendale never announced the firing of Gonzalez. The letter from Phelps was dated December 8th and was provided by police spokesperson Jose Santiago on January 7th in response to an inquiry about the lawsuit. Santiago said in an email that the city and police department believed the shooting was outside of policy and they felt that keeping him as a public safety officer could potentially be a safety risk to the community. The decision followed a review of the case by a Response to Resistance Board and a Citizens Review Panel, he said. Gonzalez avoided criminal charges in April when prosecutors with the Maricopa County District Attorney's Office told the Peoria Police Department, which investigated the shooting, that he wouldn't be prosecuted in Seebeck's death because there would be no reasonable likelihood of conviction. Santiago on January 7th confirmed Anakin was still with the police department. The city does not comment on pending litigation, Santiago said. Gonzalez, Anakin, and the city have not yet filed a response in court. Benjamin A. Berkman, who represents Seebeck's brother and mother in the lawsuit, said what happened to Seebeck showed that excessive force was tolerated within the police department, a belief that needed to change for the sake of the community. Not a single Glendale police officer intervened after one of their fellow officers fired two entirely unjustified shots at an unarmed man from hundreds of feet away. Berkman said in the statement, their inaction enabled the officer to fire two more entirely unjustified shots at Dylan, killing him. The lawsuit claims the Glendale Police Department has a pattern of using excessive force. It lists 9 incidents dating back to 2015, including when an officer used a stun gun 11 times on Johnny Whitcroft, who was on the ground and handcuffed. The city failed to properly train and discipline officers for using excessive force, the suit said, which has led officers like Gonzalez to believe their actions would not be meaningfully scrutinized or subject to discipline. Gonzalez and Anakin failed to render aid and interfered with a familial relationship, the suit said. Gonzalez was also separately accused of excessive force and unlawful seizure, while Anakin was accused of failing to intervene and supervise. What upsets us is that what happened to Dylan could happen to anyone, Seebeck's brother, Arliss Seebeck, said in a statement released by his lawyer. It could have been anyone in the park at that time, and unfortunately it was my brother. Seebeck enjoyed making people laugh and would do anything for the people he cared about, his brother said. His death, he said, has left a mark on the family. The lawsuit didn't specify how much money Seebeck's family wants. It does seek compensatory and punitive damages, attorney's fees, and other costs the court deems just and appropriate. On January 8, 2025, Glendale police officers visited the park to look for a man who was accused by his ex-girlfriend of threatening her with a gun, according to Peoria's police, who investigated the shooting. Police found a vehicle the woman had described at the park and gave verbal commands to the man to come out, but officers said the windows were too darkly tinted to see if anyone was inside, according to Glendale and Peoria police. Officers saw Seebeck under a gazebo in the park and thought he was the man they were looking for, said Peoria police. A briefing released by Glendale's police, which included snippets of body camera footage, shows officers commanding Seebeck to walk toward them with his hands up and on his head. Seebeck could not be seen in the video that was shared. Peoria police said an officer then shot Seebeck after he appeared to reach for his waistband. The shooting officer, according to the lawsuit, was Gonzalez. Seebeck died at the scene and officers did not find a firearm on him. Seebeck had just been released and placed on community supervision by the Arizona Department of Corrections on December 30th. He was in prison serving a sentence for a burglar conviction, according to the department's website. Seebeck's medical examiner report, which was released by the county on April 25th, said he died from one shot to the chest. It also said a police dog bit him. Glendale police officers, after the shooting, approached the vehicle and found the man they were seeking with an apparent self-inflicted shotgun wound, according to Peoria's police. He was transported to a hospital where he later died. The next article is titled Indigenous Residents Fret Over Phoenix Ice Buildup. This article was written by Alyssa D. Bicente of the Arizona Republic. As more ICE agents descend into Phoenix with the power to racially profile granted to them by the U.S. Supreme Court, concern is growing for the urban indigenous population. Phoenix is the largest U.S. city for Native American residents. As early as when President Donald Trump signed his executive order in January 25th targeting the deportation of immigrants to the country illegally, incidents had already occurred indicating that indigenous individuals were targeted by immigration and customs enforcement. The day after a woman in Minneapolis was shot and killed by an ICE officer, it was reported that a Native American man in Minneapolis was punched and taken by ICE agents even after complying and saying he was indigenous and a U.S. citizen. The encounter was caught on camera on the same day that Oglala Sioux tribal member and President Frank Starr posted on his Facebook page that four tribal members were detained in Minneapolis. The men detained were homeless and were living under the bridge near the Little Earth housing project. There have been multiple incidents in which ICE officials appeared to show little regard for whether a person was Native American or a member of a federally recognized tribe. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs press secretary Liliana Soto said in a text to the Arizona Republic that with the expansion of ICE in Phoenix, the governor's office has contacted the federal government to get more information and has been in touch with tribal leaders since last year to share information and expand existing lines of communication. Governor Hobbs remained clear. Arizona is focused on fighting crime, getting drugs from our streets, and securing the border. She supports law enforcement that prioritizes public safety over political stunts designed to create chaos and instill fear, and rejects policies that chase deportation quotas at the expense of stopping drug smuggling and human trafficking. Soto also added Arizona will not participate in indiscriminately rounding up individuals, violating civil rights, or enforcement activities that harm our communities. If this administration increases activity here, we encourage them to align with Focus and fulfill President Trump's promise to get drug dealers and criminals off the street. Leaders from the Gila River Indian Community and the Salt River Pima-Maricopa Indian Community did not respond to requests for comments regarding the increased presence of ICE officials in the Phoenix area. Along with the Fort McDonald's Yavapai Nation, these tribes are among the reservations closest to Phoenix, and their citizens make up part of the city's over 65,000 Native American residents. Phoenix has a large Navajo population with more than 50,000 tribal members, according to a Navajo Epidemiology Center report. Last January, Navajo leadership advised citizens to carry their certificate of Indian blood or tribal identification card. However, reports that ICE authorities have not consistently recognized these documents as valid have raised concerns that tribal members could still be retained. Indigenous people are the first people of this country. Unfortunately, our communities have long endured the consequences of federal policies carried out without regard for our rights and livelihoods, said Navajo speaker Crystalline Curley. It's estimated that more than 60,000 members of the Navajo Nation live in the Phoenix and surrounding areas, with the potential increase in ICE presence in Phoenix. We unfortunately anticipate that tribal members will be impacted through racial profiling and unnecessary encounters that place our people at risk. It is critical that tribes are engaged and work together throughout, and we work proactively with federal and state officials to mitigate and minimize these impacts, protect our rights, and ensure the safety and dignity of our people, Curley said. The Navajo Nation's Rainbow Bridge program, established to assist Navajo citizens displaced by fraudulent sober living homes, includes a section on its website dedicated to providing resources for Navajo citizens who may be detained by ICE. Over the summer, Reva Stewart and her nonprofit Turtle Island Warrior Woman, which assists indigenous individuals displaced by fraudulent sober living homes, said as a direct result of Trump's mass deportations, the indigenous population feels increasingly targeted, with fears of being detained simply for being unsheltered or for the skin color. As Stewart's volunteers continue street outreach to the unsheltered, she said they also work to educate them about ICE-related activities. We tell them what is going on. This law was passed. You need to take care of yourself. Do you have your CIB, the Certificate of Indian Blood? Do you have your Social Security card? Do you know your census number? Tribal affiliation, said Stewart in a previous interview. We had a couple of people who were arrested that were down here by ICE. I told the team we have to continue to go out there. Our next item is titled A Day of Remembrance. This comes directly from the Arizona Daily Star. Winds buffeted the Gabe Zimmerman Trailhead in Vail on Saturday for the commemoration of the 15th anniversary of the mass shooting targeting then-Representative Gabrielle Giffords that took Zimmerman's life and five others. Giffords and her husband, U.S. Senator Mark Kelly, were on hand as dozens of hikers prepared to head down the trails. Kelly said Zimmerman was like a younger brother to her, Giffords added. Losses hurt, setbacks are hard, but I tell myself to move ahead. Not interesting, important news article from the Nation and the World section. Article's title is Criticism Grows for Trump's Golden Fleet Plan. This article was written by Edmund H. Mahoney of Hartford Courant. President Donald Trump's year-end announcement that he's redirecting decades of U.S. naval planning by re-emphasizing surface rather than submarine warfare with construction of a new class of battleship is running into a buzzsaw of skepticism and could face a congressional challenge. Among the critics is U.S. Representative Joe Courtney, Democrats of Connecticut, now ranking member and, if Democrats take the House in midterm election next fall, likely chairman of the House Armed Services Committee's influential Sea Power Subcommittee. I would love to have a hearing on the CPAR subcommittee on how battleships make any sense, given that we already have what we already have got in the hopper, Courtney said during a recent interview. By rights, our committee should be all over this. Starting a class of Navy warships is not about satisfying some obsession with aesthetics, but rather about strengthening our force posture and Navy personnel in a new, highly contested maritime domain, he said. Submarines, destroyers, and carriers accomplish that goal by distributing sea power, unlike battleships that we know from World War II are dangerously vulnerable from the air and on the sea. We can do much better than living in the past. Trump provoked a chorus of such questions across the shipbuilding industry when he announced that at a news conference December 22nd, from which uniformed U.S. Navy personnel were absent, a modernization program he called the Golden Fleet. His plan is focused on construction of a new class of high-tech battleships he designated the Trump class as part of a naval fleet that for decades has been built on unrivaled submarine technology. For years, Trump has talked of upgrading a U.S. war fleet he has called terrible-looking and covered in rust. As you know, we're desperately in need of ships, he said. Our ships, some of them have gotten old and tired and obsolete. As a commander-in-chief, it's my great honor to announce that I've approved a plan for the Navy to begin the construction of two brand-new, very large, the largest we've ever built, battleships. The Congressional Research Service reported on December 30th that Trump's battleship fleet, as proposed, could reach as many as 20 to 25 ships. Courtney said the first ship of the class, the first ship is usually the costliest in any class, could cost as much as $15 billion. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the January 12th, 2026 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.